Now, last week I looked at the background to the covenants. I looked at the background of the Scottish Reformation of the late 16th century. I looked at the tussle that there was between the supporters of an episcopal form of church government, where church government was ruled by bishops and archbishops, and ultimately the king was the head of the church, and those who wished to see a Presbyterian system of church government. Remember the remark by Andrew Melville, who declared boldly to King James that there were two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There was King James, who was the king of the state, and there was King Jesus, who was the king of the church. We also looked at the background to the beginnings of Presbyterianism in Ireland. We looked at the work of men such as Edward Bryce or Robert Blair and Bangor, effect of the Six Mile Water Revival of the 1620s. And then we looked at the actual covenants themselves, the two covenants of great importance, the 1638 National Covenant in Scotland and the 1643 Solemn League and Covenant, which affected all three kingdoms, England, Ireland and Scotland. And basically both covenants, you could say, were a sworn declaration that those who subscribed to it were affirming the principles of the Reformation. They were setting out very clearly that Presbyterianism was the biblical form of church government, and that the king and the state should have no right to interfere in the church. In 1644, as we looked at, Solemn League and Covenant was brought to Ireland and signed at 26 places across the province of Ulster. It was also signed by a few in Dublin as well, but principally it was signed in the province of Ulster. Some 16,000 ordinary people had signed it by late May 1644. Now, much happened in the years following the signing of the covenant that was to have major repercussions that still come down to the present day. The Westminster Assembly was constituted, and that brought together ministers and non-ministers, for that matter, from across England and Scotland, who together formulated various policies in relation to the governance of the church and in codifying doctrine. And out of the Westminster Assembly came the Westminster Confession of Faith and the larger and shorter catechisms. And these are documents that are still in use today in Presbyterian and Reformed Presbyterian churches, not just here in Ireland, but around the world. These are still regarded as the text setting out the church's position on government, how it governs its affairs, and on its understanding of basic principles as set out in the Bible. No way were they meant to replace the Bible, they were simply meant to be a means of explaining more clearly the position of the church on certain matters. So the Westminster Assembly met between 1643 and 1649, and its legacy is still very much with us today. Now, from the 1640s onwards, we see congregations being formed in Ireland, Presbyterian congregations. Although, as I mentioned last week, there were men with Presbyterian convictions who were ministering in Ireland, they operated within a Church of Ireland system. So it was still a system where bishops and archbishops were governing the church, but these were men with Presbyterian convictions who were allowed a certain degree of latitude to maintain their own principles and beliefs in their parishes. That ends in the 1630s. But from the 1640s, following on from the first Irish Presbytery being established in 1642, Solemn League and Covenant, 1644 in Ireland, we see congregations, actual congregations, distinct Presbyterian congregations actually established. And these are some of the earliest ministers in our own area. The earliest was a man called David Buttle in Ballymena, who was there from 1645. And interestingly, in the 1630s, a Buttle was an innkeeper in Ballymena. So it's highly likely that there was a familial connection between the two. Other early ministers include John Shaw at Ahuhill. And interesting, I was driving past Ahuhill, the new church they're building in Ahuhill, and I see on it says established 1654. Well, Shaw was there from 1658. His brother was James Shaw, who was a minister of Carnmoney at this time. Out at Brashean, or the congregation originally known as Braid, John Douglas from 1655. At Clock, or Donaghy Parish, Andrew Rowan, we'll come back to him in due course. Over at Connor, Robert Duart, and at Dromahl, John Coulter. Dromahl would be the forerunner of Randallstown, the various churches in Randallstown. Randallstown, as a name, did not exist at that time. It didn't come into existence as a name, Randallstown, until the latter part of the 1600s, around about 1680. And across Ireland, there were other Presbyterian congregations being established, and ministers, mainly from Scotland, not exclusively so, but mainly from Scotland, who were ordained to these parishes. So this was a time of great encouragement for the Presbyterians in Ulster. Interestingly, if you look at a map showing the distribution of churches in use in 1657, it's quite clear that many of these services must have been held in the open air, because the number of churches in use was really quite small. You can see quite a few up in the north of County Antrim. You can see, for example, the likes of Ballymoney and Kilrats, Derrykegan, which would be Derbrook, Belly, Ballantoy, Ballyrasheen, Ballywillan. Many of the ruins of these churches are still around today. But look in mid-Antrim, the centre of Antrim. You've really only got the church of Clock in the centre of Antrim. Over on the coast, you've got the likes of Glenarm, Cairncastle, Larne. But in terms of the provision of meeting houses, there certainly doesn't seem to have been a great many of them in Antrim as a whole. And certainly in mid-Antrim, there seems to be an absolute dearth of them. There is a reference from 1658 to a meeting house, a thatched meeting house in Ballymena, which may or may not be on the site of the present First Ballymena, but certainly from 1658 there was a meeting house in Ballymena. That's the only church then in mid-Antrim that is recorded as having been in use in 1657. That's a church at Clock, just when you turn up, you turn off the dual carriageway, just when the dual carriageway ends, you go up the hill. Clock Graveyard is on the right-hand side, just before you come up to Clock Village. That's a church where the Reverend Andrew Rowan was preaching from the late 1650s. And the ruins of it, as you can see, are still there. Note the large bell cot above the west gable, a very typically Scottish feature. Fairly simple church, simple rectangular building, nothing elaborate, no fine tower or spire or anything like that. Fairly simple meeting house, one would say. Now, interestingly, in Ballymena in the late 1650s, from the late 1650s, there were a number of meetings which could be described as synods. And these meetings were where all the representatives of all the congregations in the north of Ireland met together. And this, you would have to say, as it says, the quote from Adair, Patrick Adair's narrative, there was a presbytery at Ballymena where all the four meetings were present on the 8th of April 1659. Some called it the General Presbytery, some called it a Synod. So this is like the first time that representatives from all the congregations were coming together in one place to conduct their business, and it was in Ballymena. No doubt reflecting its central location in terms of the overall strength of Presbyterianism in Ulster at that time. Now, the situation changes quite rapidly. Throughout the 1650s, Oliver Cromwell, well not throughout the 1650s, but for most of the 1650s, Oliver Cromwell was the dominant figure in politics in the British Isles, the Lord Protector. He came to Ireland in 1649 and very clearly stamped his authority on the island. In fact, interestingly, the very first siege of Derry took place in 1649, and whereas the more famous siege of 1689, on the one hand you had the supporters of King William inside the walls, supporters of King James outside the walls. In 1649, you had the supporters of Oliver Cromwell inside the walls, and outside the walls besieging the city was an army of Ulster Scots Presbyterians who were furious that Cromwell and his supporters had executed the king, because the Scots Presbyterians were still very much royalist in their sympathies. Yes, they had challenged the right of the king to rule over the church. They were very clear that the king should have no say in the running of the church, but still at heart they were royalists. They supported King Charles, and after his execution they continued to support, many of them continued to support Prince Charles. Now Cromwell was no Presbyterian. In fact, Cromwell was what you would just call a Congregationalist, an independent. To begin with, he certainly had no desire to support the Presbyterians, even though he himself had subscribed to the Solemn League of Covenant, Solemn League and Covenant back in 1643. I mentioned last week that he had a scheme to transplant leading Presbyterians in Ulster to the south and west of Ireland, basically remove them from Ulster to somewhere they couldn't cause any trouble. That scheme was never implemented. And in time, Cromwell, you might say, became a bit more tolerant of Presbyterians in Ulster. Now, he dies in 1658. His son takes over for a while, but his son is certainly not the man that his father was. And in 1660, we have both the restoration of the monarchy, with Charles II coming back and assuming the throne, and we have the restoration of the established Episcopal Church. It didn't necessarily have to be like that. At one time it looked as if Presbyterianism would be recognised by the new king as the legitimate form of church government, but in the end it's the Episcopal party which wins out, and episcopacy is restored. Now that places Presbyterian ministers in a very difficult situation. Many of them simply refuse to recognise the authority of bishops and archbishops. Now, one of the most implacable opponents of Presbyterianism was Bishop Jeremy Taylor. Taylor was a leading writer and leading thinker of his age, one of the leading writers and leading thinkers of his age. He had spent part of the 1650s in exile, and he had found, you know, somewhere to shelter on the shores of Loch Ney. But in 1661, he's the man chosen by the king to be the new bishop of Down and Connor. These dioceses would take in, well, Connor is more or less County Antrim, Down is much of County Down, so he was bishop over a huge area. And Taylor was going to have no truck with Presbyterianism. It was simply his way or no way. And despite attempts to negotiate with him or to reason with him, he simply dismissed the Presbyterians ministers at as he put it, a committee of Scotch spiders. Was how he rather dismissively considered them, a committee of Scotch spiders. And one day, as it says, again referring to Bishop Adair, or Patrick Adair's narrative rather, but this bishop did in one day declare 36 congregations vacant. He simply held them not to be ministers, they not being ordained by bishops. So he simply said, these ministers are not ministers. They haven't been ordained by bishops, so they're out. They are no longer ministers. And so they were dismissed, they were like excommunicated, they were thrown out of their ministerial charges. Of the 68 Presbyterian ministers in the north of Ireland at that time, 61 were expelled. Only 7 decided to conform to the established church. So 61 of the 68 were thrown out of their congregations. Interestingly, one of those to conform was Andrew Rowan at Clock. And he, having been the Presbyterian minister of Clock, became the Church of Ireland minister in Clock, and so remained until the early 18th century. But he was one of the very few who conformed, who gave in when the pressure was put on him. Now, for the most part, these ministers did not flee back to Scotland. Most of them, nearly all of them, continued to stay in their localities and continued to minister to their congregations. Their congregations who came out with them, who would not go to the church now to hear a Church of Ireland minister, who withdrew from that and stayed with their own Presbyterian ministers. In fact, in Kilrats, when the new Church of Ireland minister turned up at his church to deliver a sermon, he found the rotting carcasses of 2 sheep hanging from the rafters. Very powerful reminder of those momentous days. This is at Ballyrasheen Presbyterian Church, and you can see the plaque built into the wall. And this is in memory of Robert Hogshead, and the plaque reads, who was ordained minister of the parish of Ballyrasheen in October 1657 and ejected by a troop of dragoons in 1661 for his loyalty to Christ's crown and covenant, of whom the world was not worthy. So it's interesting there, they have that plaque as a reminder. And Hogshead remembers just one of 61. Many of these other ministers could tell similar stories. In the Ballymena area, the men I've mentioned, people like John Shaw at Ahockle or David Buettel at Ballymena, these men stayed on. They did not flee. They did not cave in. And despite pressure and persecution, they continued to minister to the needs of their local congregations. Now, one of the first acts, or an early act, of the newly restored restoration regime was for the burning of the covenant. The covenant was to be publicly burned. And this act was passed both in England, Ireland and Scotland. One man refused, John Dalway at Carrickfergus, but eventually he too gave in when he was brought to Dublin and forced to his knees in front of the Irish House of Lords and fined £100. So the covenant is now declared a document of traitors, one that should not be countenanced, one that should be ignored or abjured at all costs. Now, to return to Scotland. And here too we have a similar situation. We have bishops and episcopacy restored as the official form of church government. And there too, in 1662 and 1663, we have hundreds, in this case 400, I think it was, 400 ministers who were ejected from their parishes because of their Presbyterianism and their support for the covenants. And in Scotland, the state really came down very, very hard on anyone who disagreed with this. You can see some slides there showing scenes from the killing times in Scotland. You can see in the one, the top one, a field preacher with his congregation. You see the men and the horses in the background watching out for government troops who would sweep down and seek to wipe them out. You can see the colour painting at the bottom, a Covenanter wedding held in a secret, out-of-the-way place. And on the right-hand side, you can see a figure imagining of a Covenanter preacher encouraging the faithful in their difficulties. Now, the killing times as a term has been applied in various ways. In its broadest sense, it covers the period from 1661 through to 1688. In a more narrow sense, it applies to a particularly severe period in the mid-1680s, when government reprisals against Covenanters were exceptionally extreme, harrowing is the only way to describe what happens at that time. Now, throughout Scotland, there are monuments to the Covenanters. Here's one in Ayr. I photographed it just a few weeks ago when I was there. It's in the same graveyard as the monument to William Adair, the man who brought the Covenant to Ballymena. And you can see it commemorates seven men who, as it says, suffered martyrdom at Ayr on the 27th of December 1666 for their adherence to the Word of God and Scotland's covenanted work of reformation. That headstone was erected in 1814. There, eight men were brought to trial for their support for the covenants, for their Presbyterianism. They were sentenced to death, but no one could be found to carry out the sentence. The Ayr hangman ran away. The Irvine hangman would not do it, even after being tortured. And in the end, they persuaded one of the eight men that he would go free if he hanged the seven others. And that is indeed what happened. One of the men gave in, and he was the one who placed the noose around the necks of each of his former comrades. And so they died. One of the worst incidents took place in 1685, in May 1685. Philip has alluded to it already. And this was the incident in which those who died were known as the Wigtown Martyrs. At Wigtown today, if you walk down past the church down towards the shore, it's quite far inland now, but it would have been right on the shore at one time. You can see the monument to the two Margarets. Margaret Wilson, who was aged 18, and Margaret McLachlan, or Lacklison, who was a widow, aged 63. And these women were arrested by government authorities. They were charged with all sorts of crimes that they simply couldn't have even been guilty of. Charge of being involved in various incidents and battles. No basis in fact. And they would not declare their opposition to the covenants. They would not declare that, in their view, the king was the head of the church. The king had authority over the church. So they were sentenced to death, and sentenced to death by drowning. They were tied to stakes in the Solway Firth, and they were drowned in the rising tide. The older woman was tied to a stake further out to sea, in the hope that seeing her drown would persuade the younger woman to recant, but no, she too drowned as the waves washed over her, aged just 18. And you can see the drawing, the 19th century drawing by Millais, of Margaret Wilson tied to the stake in the Solway Firth in May 1685. And in the graveyard in Wigtown, you can see the monument to these women. There was a great attempt to try and show that this was simply a figment of the imagination of Covenanters wanting to show the government was as bad as it possibly was. There were those who denied that this incident ever happened. But the monuments are there, and contemporary writings also prove that this incident really did happen. There is absolutely no doubt that this harrowing and horrible death of these two women did actually occur. And those were just some of the many, many incidents that happened at that time. If you go to Greyfriars Graveyard in Scotland, you can see the Covenanter monument. And there it records that 18,000 perished or suffered in one way or another for their support for the covenants at the hands of a state that was determined to break them, break their will, break their sympathies. 18,000, says, from the execution of the Marquess of Argyll in 1661 to the execution of James Rennick in 1688. Now, many of these people were executed, but many of them were simply shot in the fields. At one point, basically the government allowed anyone even suspected of sympathy with the Covenanters to be executed, summarily executed in the fields, shot where they worked or shot where they were hiding. And also in Greyfriars Graveyard, you can see what's known as the Covenanters' Prison, a place where arrested Covenanters were herded and kept in squalid conditions over a winter. So there are many reminders in Scotland of these times throughout, especially the south-west of Scotland. You will find many old graveyards containing these monuments, or many memorials standing in places where these incidents took place. Now, in Ireland, the persecution of the Covenanters was never anywhere near as severe as it was in Scotland. You didn't have these mass executions or random executions or people being shot in the fields. And so here we cannot say that the persecution was anywhere near like what it was in Scotland. But in fact, Ulster was a place of refuge for Covenanters fleeing from the persecution in Scotland. And memories of that continued right down to the 19th century. In the 1830s in Rakavan Parish, for example, that would be like going up the Braid Valley, there was still a memory that the people of that time, that their ancestors had come across at the times of the wars in Scotland. And they remembered about the broken covenant. So there was still that strong sense of this connection with events in late 17th century Scotland. So Ulster was a place of refuge. And many people came across and found shelter. Now, one of the more famous was a man called Willie Gilliland. He came across here, I think, at the end of the 1670s. And he found shelter in the Glenwherry area. An area today that if you're ever driving up to Larne to get the ferry to Scotland, you'll be driving through Glenwherry. And in the 19th century, his ancestor, Sir Samuel Ferguson, who was one of the giants of Irish poetry in the 19th century, composed these verses. This is just an extract. It's a very long poem. But he writes, "Upon the mountain solitudes and in a rebel ring, he has worshipped God upon the hill in spite of church and king. And sealed his treason with his blood, on Bothwell Bridge he hath, so he must fly his father's land, or he must die the death. And so in moor and mountain, from Lagan to the Ban, from house to house and hill to hill, he lurked an outlawed man. At last, when in false company he might no longer bide, he stayed his houseless wanderings upon the Collin side." And the Collin is referring to that area out above Ballyclare, going up to Glenwherry. Bothwell Bridge was a battle involving the Covenanters and government troops in 1679, in which many Covenanters died, and as a result, or in its aftermath, many fled to Ulster. Willie Gilliland among them. Now, another of the more famous men who sought refuge in Ulster was Alexander Peden. Peden was from the parish of Sorn in Ayrshire. He was an ordained minister in the church in Scotland, but he was one of the many who was forced out, who was expelled in the early 1660s for support for the covenants. And for the rest of his life, he basically lived the life of an outlaw. He lived on the run. And at different times, he sought refuge in Ireland. One of the places he's particularly associated with is, again, Glenwherry. It seems to have been that people coming across from Scotland, maybe one of the first places they were landing was in the Larne or Glenarm areas, and they would make their way inland to a place that at that time would have been considered fairly remote. And in the life written of him, it's described his work in that area. It says he was a blessed instrument in the conversion of some and civilizing of others, though the place was noted for a rude, wild people. And no offense to anyone who may be from Glenwary here tonight. It was with a family called Steele at Glenwary that he sought much shelter, or he sheltered for a particular time. And in 1972, a monument was erected at that farmstead in memory of Peden's presence there. And you can see it says, Alexander Peden, Prophet of the Covenanters, lived here 1682 to 1685. Now, the term Prophet of the Covenanters has led some to maybe misunderstand Peden. I don't want you to think of him as a sort of a Nostradamus type figure who was predicting the future and coming up with all sorts of mystical sayings. I think we should understand prophet as simply meaning a preacher, someone who was still fully convinced of his calling as a minister, and would continue to preach wherever he was, in Scotland or in Ireland. Now, Peden, as I said, was on the run. And on the left, you can see a disguise, a mask he wore when he was fleeing from government authorities. He wore this mask basically so he wouldn't be recognised on his wanderings. The mask is in the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh. And I have to say, if I was out for a walk on a lonely moor and I saw a man coming towards me dressed like that, I think I would take to my heels and run as fast as I could. On the right, you can see a book that was published in a number of years, about just a few years ago, about Peden. It's a reprint of a life, a biography of him, published in Belfast in 1755, and also includes additional information. There are dozens of sites across Scotland associated with Peden in one way or another, places where he sought refuge, places where he preached. Of the many Covenanter ministers who lived as outlaws, who were in defiance of the government, he was one of the very few to die of natural causes. Many of the others were executed, but Peden died of natural causes. And even after his death, government troops came to the graveyard to dig up his body so it could be put on show and mocked. But the local people, the local laird, would not allow this to happen. Such was the regard in which he was held. Now, by the time Peden was here, we've reached a stage which is very difficult to explain. And I haven't yet seen where it has been adequately explained. And this is where you see a divergence within Presbyterianism. Up to this point, I've been talking about Presbyterians, which has really been synonymous with Covenanters. But from the 1670 onwards, you see a divergence. You see a move, a separation between those who are certainly convinced of Presbyterianism, but who are not holding the covenants in the same regard, who are not still looking for the covenants in the way that they had formerly done so. And a minority who are still believing that the covenants are the basis of the relationship between church and state and the basis of their particular form of church government of Presbyterianism. So it's hard to explain, and I've never really seen anybody do it adequately. But from this time on, we see the Covenanters, those we would term Covenanters, where the Reformed Presbyterian Church comes from today, separating from those who are still Presbyterians, but they were not, they did not view the covenants in the same way that they had originally done. And these covenanters organized themselves into societies for their mutual encouragement. This happened in Scotland and it happened in Ireland. I'll talk more about the nature of these societies in a moment. But these societies in Ireland had been organised from the 1680s. And this comment here, this is James Rennick, regarded as one of the last principal martyrs for the covenant, executed in Edinburgh in 1688. And he's writing in July 1687, there are sundry societies in Ireland come out from the defections of the time, who are keeping correspondence with us. I am desired to visit them, and I purpose, God willing, to do it. When Mr. David Houston was there in the end of the spring, he was very free, and considerable numbers attended his preaching. Note the name there, David Houston. And like Peden, Houston is one of the key figures in the Covenanter story in Ireland in the late 17th century. Houston was a licentiate of the Presbyterian Church, but gradually became estranged from them because of his adherence to the covenants and because he regularly preached on their importance. And so he gradually became estranged from the main body of Presbyterians and began to be very much associated with those who still held to the covenants, the Covenanters, both in Scotland and Ireland. These are some of the places on this map associated with David Houston. For a time, you can see he actually preached in Newcastle upon Tyne, but there are many places in the north of Ireland with which he is also associated, especially Ballymoney, Glenarm, and this area where we are now, Hochul, Ballymena, Cullibacky. Interestingly, at the time of the Siege of Derry, he does play his own part. This is from Hempton's History of the Siege. And Hempton writes, the Covenanters took a decided and energetic part against James and Tyrconnell, Tyrconnell being one of King James's chief lieutenants. Their earliest leader in Ireland was the Reverend David Houston, or Houston, who promptly marshalled 4 or 5 companies of his sturdy fellows, who were most numerous between Randallstown and Ballymoney. In all probability, these formed part of the forces who defended the passage of the ban. Well, between Randallstown and Ballymoney, well, that's the area we're in now, after all. And this is one of the areas where Houston had the most supporters. Now, Houston was someone who was back and forth across the North Channel with some regularity. At one point, he was arrested in Ireland and taken to Scotland and would almost certainly have been executed but for a band of Covenanters who came to his rescue and freed him from his captors. Comes back to Ireland, and in 1694, he's described by a Church of Ireland bishop as a clergyman that preached up the Solemn League and Covenant, accusing the people of Scotland for not sticking to their league and having a congregation of 500 resolute fellows that adhere to him. And at that time, he was living in the Armoy area of County Antrim. And Professor Lockridge, in his History of Ballymoney, or sorry, his History of Cullibacky, writes, the congregation of Cullibacky owes an incalculable debt to David Houston. His ministry helped to lay foundations on which a structure was later built. So though Houston was never, you might say, an ordained Covenanter minister, yet his preaching and his ministry among Covenanters here was critical to their creation of their own separate identity. And through that, ultimately, it led to the creation of the Reformed Presbyterian Church. Houston died in 1696, and he was buried at Connor. You can see there the Connor Church of Ireland. Well, he was buried in the graveyard beside that church. But at one time, someone appropriated his tombstone for another purpose, and so it has been lost today. But over at Kelswater, on the Memorial Hall, you can see where the inscription reads, erected by Henry H. Houston of Philadelphia, USA, in honour of his kinsman, the Reverend David Houston, M.A., who was buried by members of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Connor Graveyard under the following inscription, which has long since been obliterated. Here lies the body of Mr. David Houston, a faithful minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, who departed this life the, I think it's 8th of December in the year 1696, and of his age, the 63rd year. So though the tombstone doesn't survive, we at least have the inscription that has been preserved. We now move into what can only be regarded as a fairly silent era in the history of the Covenanters in Ireland. From the death of David Houston in 1696, over six decades were to pass when the Covenanters here had no minister of their own. They had no meeting houses, and there were no congregations. There are a few references to the Irish Covenanters in the minutes of the Scottish Covenanters. This is one, for example, from January 1735. It refers to as poor suffering remnant in our neighbouring covenanted kingdom of Ireland. But for the most part, this is a silent era. We really know very little at all about the Covenanters. We do know that they kept in close correspondence with their brethren in Scotland. We do know that John Macmillan, the Scottish Covenanter minister, did come to Ireland on a number of occasions, and we know that representatives from Ireland went to Scotland. But apart from that, we know very, very little. However, meetings were held, and one of the places where meetings, where gatherings of Covenanters took place, was at the Roundhole at Laymore, just off the old Ballymoney Road, north of Ballymena. That's the Laymore. It's a natural amphitheatre. It is a round hole. It's a natural amphitheatre where people would have gathered to hear a minister preach to them. David Houston may well have preached here. Maybe even, for all we know, Alexander Peden also preached here. And there is a plaque erected by Ballymena Borough Council commemorating the fact that this was a place for conventicles, open-air gatherings of the Covenanters. Now, I mentioned the fact that Covenanters organised themselves into societies for their mutual encouragement. Now, how were these societies organised, or what really were they? Well, if I quote again from Professor Lockridge, he writes, "The fellowship meetings of societies, as they were called, were well organised and exercised strict supervision over members. The pattern followed was similar to that of their Scottish brethren, and while they had no minister in a regular sense, men of gifts acted as teachers and exhorters and helped to maintain a unity and witness among the societies." So this was the basis of their organisation, and the strength of this system of organisation meant that the Covenanters were able to come through a period over decades, where they had no ministers of their own, no congregations, no meeting houses. Excuse me. Now, an interesting insight into Covenanters in County Antrim in the 18th century comes from a William Findlay. Findlay, born around about 1741 in County Antrim, emigrates to America in 1763. Moves to Pennsylvania, Westmoreland County, that's in western Pennsylvania, 1783. Becomes involved in politics, elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. And by 1811, he is the original father of the House, the oldest and longest serving of any of the legislators in that House. And eventually retires from Congress in 1817. And Findlay is born into and grows up in a Covenanter family in County Antrim in the mid-18th century. In 1811 or so, Findlay leaves what could be regarded as something like an autobiography, and leaves some fascinating insights into what life was like, what his upbringing was like in this Covenanter family in mid-18th century County Antrim. He writes, "I had a strictly religious education from my parents, assisted by religious societies for prayer and conference, supply the want of public worship, and to them I was early introduced. My father had a larger library of church history and divinity than many of his neighbours. To these means I am under great obligations for any early religious knowledge that I possessed or impressions that I experienced. It's fascinating. My father had a larger library of church history. So he grew up in a house full of books, and he read those books, and he took in what they were saying. And on societies, Findlay observes, the old dissenters, that is, the Covenanters, being long without a minister in session, and much longer without a presbytery, conducted their religious affairs and testimony by what they called society, corresponding, and general meetings, both in Scotland and Ireland. The two last were composed of representatives from societies, and sometimes delegates went from the general meetings of Ireland to Scotland. So again, there's interaction between Covenanters in Scotland, Covenanters in Ireland. And there are some of the societies associated with Collibaci that have survived in the historical record. Obviously, in the area we are now, we can see Ahochel, Ballymena, Carnley, Collibaci, Dromahl, but even you can see on the right-hand side, Glen Ravel is mentioned. Kirk and Riola is mentioned. Loch McGarry, upper and lower Banside, well, that will be over towards Port Blanowen. So these are like where the societies in the Collibaci area meeting. Just to give you that, those of you who are familiar with the area will know where these places are much better than me, for instance. But it gives you an idea of the geographical spread of the different societies around Collibaci. So we're going over towards Port Glenowen, heading up the Cushendall Road towards Glen Ravel, heading north towards Craigs, south as far as Dromahl. In 1757, a very important event took place in Covenanter history in Ireland, because for the first time, the Covenanters in Ireland had a minister of their own. There was a man called the Reverend William Martin, born at Ballyspallan near Limavady, educated at Glasgow University, and licensed to preach by the Scottish Reformed Presbytery in 1756. And he's ordained at the Vow near Ballymoney in 1757. The first Covenanter minister ordained in Ireland. There is the plaque at the Vow commemorating his ordination. At the Vow was the location of a ferry crossing. It was a place where Covenanters from the Londonderry side of the Ban could easily reach. Covenanters from Antrim could come together as well. And at that location, beside the old graveyard at the Vow, they held their meeting and they held their ordination. I'll be talking more about Martin next week. Martin eventually goes to America and plays his own part in the American War of Independence. But that's for next week. And in 1760, Martin bases himself at Kelswater. A former mill building is refurbished as a meeting place, a meeting house. The building we see now dates from the early 19th century, but it stands on the site of its predecessor. So an old mill is converted to a meeting house, and Martin bases himself here. So in a short space of time, the Covenanters in Ireland have their own minister, and now their own meeting house. And this would have been the place, before there was a church here in Collibaci, that the Covenanters in this area would have gathered for worship, for weddings, for baptisms, and so on. So it's a far cry from the days of persecution, from the days when Alexander Peden and David Houston were preaching to small scattered groups. Now we have the real beginnings of the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And next week, I'll be looking at how that story develops and moves on from that. So thank you very much.